It's like biblical and disgusting, and they attack you, they'll fly in your hair, and it's just the worst thing ever. And everyone knows I'm really afraid of them, so they all keep sending me pictures.
Welcome back, debriefers. We are back for another episode this week. Of course, joining me as always is former DFL research director, now political consultant, Will Davis.
Hello, hello. Good to be back.
Will, I'm so grateful you're here. It's spring. Really? Baseball has started. I heard you went the other day.
I did. I love opening day, opening home series day, yes, or whatever. That's so fun. It's nothing like it in
exactly
sports.
Exactly right. Now, I would say we're joined by Darwin, but Darwin Forsyth is no longer with us.
May he rest in peace.
He's still with us. He still works here, but he's not here today.
Poor Darwin just goes on vacation.
I know.
He's been on vacation like twice in the last month, I think. What's going on with this guy?
He's getting him in before things get too crazy, I guess.
That's probably a good idea, actually. He's probably the smart one. But
I think he actually is probably just at home, and he wanted to have a break from all of us, just mercilessly torturing him over his Olivia Rodrigo.
He's probably just rocking in a corner, a dark corner, and crying
listening
a little
to
bit.
Olivia.
Yeah.
Exactly. There you go. And of course, Madison Groh, you've decided to grace us with your presence today for some strange reason, since you don't like this podcast.
I do like this podcast, Ken. Quit spreading misinformation.
Since when do you like it?
I just don't listen to it because I listen to it when I record it with you guys.
Some logic there.
Yeah.
Some.
Not much.
Not much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Will.
So we have a different kind of episode here today, don't we?
We do, yes.
And you two were just in Toronto, right?
We were.
The second tea is silent. They get very worked up about that, apparently.
That's right.
And you want to tell us what you were doing out there?
Well, we were out in Canada, as you mentioned, in Toronto, for the Democrats Abroad. And we were over there campaigning for the president and making sure folks understand the importance of this upcoming election. You know, there are 6.5 million voting age adults, Americans, who live abroad. And of those who are registered, around 75% of them are actually Democrats.
Wow.
So every vote that comes back from abroad or overseas voters is really accruing to our benefit. And of course, we know that from personal experience here in Minnesota in 2008. As you remember, Will and Madison, when Al Franken was elected by 312 votes, the closest Senate election in our country's history, what put him over the top was, in fact, the abroad vote.
Dems abroad. Wow. Yeah, I don't remember that,
And with the absentee ballots when they came back, right? That's what put Al Franken over the top and gave him the lead. The point is that we know it through other empirical evidence, both in Arizona and Georgia in 22 in those important election, Senate elections. Again, the margin was so small and the absentee ballots from overseas voters was greater than the margin, meaning, again, that in those two Senate races, the overseas vote helped.
So Dems abroad's a very important group of people for what we're doing.
It is, and particularly in a day of really hyper-polarized electorate, right? We see the margins for these races decreasing and being much closer than they have been in the past. And so, again, anytime you can expand out the electorate by returning votes from whatever part of your state, or in this case, from around the world, it helps us. And so we were up there spending time talking to Democrats abroad in Canada. And Canada actually is the home to the second largest number of American expats living abroad. And Mexico is number one.
Okay.
So it's Mexico, Canada, and then Germany, and then the UK. And then it goes from there. But and someone asked me, well, why Germany? And I think, and I don't know this to be the fact, but there's a lot of military bases over there.
That would be my guess.
And as a result, for years now, it's just sort of spurred up this sort of American enclaves around Germany. There's a lot of expats who live over there.
Fascinating.
Yeah. One thing that's really cool about Democrats abroad when we go visit them is they almost kind of organize with like three hats on. So they're not organizing their country committee, but they're also trying to figure out how they can like best support their states back home. And they're like, I don't think they call them state committees, but there's like, you have to, you know, organize with both hands, kind of turning out the people in your home country, but also doing the work for your home state.
Right.
And so many of the students we met with who had a lot of good energy at University of Toronto, almost like all of them were from a swing state.
Yes.
Which just gets you in the corner thinking like, how are all these young people going to go back home when they graduate in the spring and turn out people?
Right.
So it's just, there's so much like upswing for like organizing.
Yeah.
It's just a cool place to go and talk to people.
That's cool. And when you say, you said 6.5 million expats?
Yes.
Do we know what percentage of that number is registered to vote?
Yeah. In fact, we do. And unfortunately, it's not as high as it should be. 23%. So about a million and a half of the 6.5 million are registered.
Okay.
And of those, 1.5 million who are registered, 80%, close to 80% are registered as Democrats.
Wow, okay.
And so the reality is, and the challenge, frankly, and I mentioned this to Democrats abroad, in the 2020 election for president, the turnout amongst Democrats abroad of those who were registered was 7.8%.
Oh.
So,
because of COVID, was it?
Well, it's a number of things, but it's very low.
Okay.
And the reality is there's huge upside, right, to turnout voters who are registered, because there's just a big ceiling here. They're at such a low turnout percentage. They're also at a low registration percentage.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I think about my work in organizing our state parties, right, there's great potential for Democrats abroad. There are a lot of great people over there, highly motivated to fight for our country and fight for our party.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, every dollar invested there really accrues to the benefit of Democrats back here.
That's really interesting, actually. And I imagine when you said they wear different hats, they have to like, Democrats Abroad is an organization, right? And then they have to worry about their home state, but then probably organizing people in the country they're living too, right?
Correct.
I mean, is that, so you're kind of like spread out all over the place. That's really interesting.
I mean, they have 52 country committees, right?
Wow.
And, you know, and some of them are small, of course, but some of them are huge, you know, where you have millions of American expats. For instance, there are over, I think, a couple million Americans alone who live in Mexico.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I have tons of family that live down there,
right,
actually. So,
right.
Yeah.
So anyways, again, and the interesting thing is there's no prohibition. People need to remember, if you're an American and you're living abroad, you have the right to vote.
Mm-hmm. No matter how long you're gone,
matter.
Is that?
Oh. It doesn't matter. If you're an American citizen, you get to vote in federal elections, wherever you live.
And, okay, but not state. I was going to ask about that.
Depends on the state.
Okay.
Well, and each state is a little different. So in some cases, some states will only allow you to vote in federal elections because that's what the Constitution, U.S. Constitution provides.
Okay.
But in other states, they restrict it just to, some states they will restrict it just to federal, and in other states they'll let you vote the whole ballot.
Okay. Right? Oh, interesting.
Like I think New Jersey lets you vote in every election,
wow,
for instance, right?
So. Fascinating. Yeah, that's really interesting stuff. And they had a podcast too.
They did, yeah. And, you know, I was able to be on the podcast.
Blue Vote Cafe.
Blue Vote Cafe. And just really great hosts. And we had a conversation with them. And I think later here today, we're going to play some excerpts from that.
Yeah. You guys were in Toronto for most of the week. So recording, tough to schedule here. Mm-hmm. Also, it's spring break. So I have my kid a bunch this week. And it's a big pain in the butt. But
what do you mean a pain in the butt? Anytime.
That
you
kid
get
does
to,
not let me.
To spend time. Not only did you name her after you, she is like your spitting image. She's your mini me.
I know.
Little Willa.
She's adorable.
Yes. You're a lucky man.
But
so.
She ignores me a lot during the day, except when it's time for a meeting, you know, like a Zoom or something. Then she comes in the room and she's like, daddy, daddy, daddy. You know, and it's just like constant. But up next, we are going to run the segment of the podcast that Ken did with Rachel Oigster and David Schellenberg of Blue Vote Cafe, which is the Dems Abroad podcast. So I hope everyone enjoys the interview.
Wonderful. Who's with us today?
Today, we are joined by Ken Martin, who is the chairman of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, and I understand one of the longest serving in that position, the president of the Association of State Democratic Committees, and a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee itself. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you so much. I really am grateful to be here. Thanks for hosting me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. We understand you are on a jaunt to our very own country of residence, Canada. So you're speaking to us from Toronto, I think, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I may be one of the few people that actually had to come south to get to Toronto, from Minneapolis. But I will tell you, it's great to be here in Toronto. We had some great events yesterday put on by the Toronto Democrats Abroad chapter. And, of course, Steve Nardi, who you all know, the vice chair of the International Democrats Abroad. So grateful to be here. Lots of great enthusiasm and excitement amongst Democrats here in Toronto.
That's wonderful. And what did you talk about with them?
Well, lots of things. Of course, really just focusing in on the importance of this upcoming election in 2024, the stakes and how important the Abroad vote is to winning elections up and down the ballot back in the States. And so, you know, there's so much to unpack from those conversations. But I left more energized than I came in, to be honest with you, to see folks who are willing to fight for their country, fight for our party and our values here in Toronto. I've had the great pleasure to travel throughout other countries around the world with Democrats Abroad. And there's just people, as I said, it's really energizing to me to see people living in other countries around the world willing to stand up for America and to stand up for our country, to stand up for our party.
So when you're back in the United States with everything you now know about Democrats Abroad, like how do you explain us to people in the United States who often seem to don't even know that we exist?
Well, look, I mean, people know back in the United States, you know, talk to folks in Georgia or Arizona as an example, right? Those elections there were decided by the return of the absentee ballots from overseas voters or abroad voters. And we're seeing, unfortunately, given how polarized the electorate is, back in the States, that these races now are being decided by razor slim margins. And of course, the margin of victory that we're seeing really is being decided by all of those votes that are returned, frankly, from countries throughout the world, from American expats who, again, care deeply about our country and their country and who are fighting for it. So, you know, look, we have, and I think you both know this, but there's around 6.5 million voting age adults living abroad. And I think that's a surprise to people when I say that. That's bigger than a lot of our states in the country, frankly. And so I would say for us, when we look at this, there's huge upside to actually organizing, mobilizing, and turning out those votes throughout the world. When you think about this, though, of those 6.5 million people who are, in fact, living abroad, only about 1.5 million of them, or 23%, are actually registered. And so there's a huge ceiling here that we haven't quite reached. So a lot more voters that are living abroad that are not registered, and we should be focusing on trying to get as many of them registered. The second piece is of those 1.5 million folks living abroad that are registered, only about 7.8% of them turned out in the last presidential election. So again, there's a huge upside of actually increasing the turnout of registered voters who are living abroad. And, you know, I think what's really astounding to me is that of those registered voters that are living abroad, based on their party preference and party registration, roughly 80% of them are, in fact, Democrats. So the work that we're doing with Democrats Abroad is so important. Every vote you can turn out really accrues to the Democratic Party advantage and our candidates' advantage. Every new voter you bring in helps us increase those margins as well. So that really was my message yesterday, just the importance of the work that folks are doing here in Canada and countries throughout the world.
Yeah, we know just from the conversations that we have that the majority of voters here are Democratic, but I hadn't heard a number before, so that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's most of that data is pulled from party registration. In most states, you have to indicate a preference when you register to vote. And so, but we know, again, look, you know, there's just a huge upside if we could increase the number of people actually registered. But also, if we just look at those folks who are registered and increased their turnout rate by 2-4% or even more, you're talking about thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of new votes coming back to the states. And again, given how close these margins are and how close we expect the margins to be in this upcoming election, this could be the decider in so many races, federal races, you know, Senate, congressional, and of course, the all important presidential race.
Absolutely. And the other interesting feature of members of Democrats Abroad and voters from abroad is that, as one of Canada's longtime leaders, Ken Sherman, used to say, we touch every single state. We're the only state party that touches all 50 states.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'm hoping to see Ken this afternoon. When I came in as chair in 2010, and I've served in this job now for 14 years, which may be a sign of my mental health. But I'll tell you, Ken was the first international Democrats abroad chair during my time. Now I had the good fortune to serve with him, and and then Katie Solon, and then of course Julia Bryan, and Candace Kirsten, and now Martha and Steve. Just really great folks. Again, you know, operating. What I've been really amazed by Democrats Abroad is, you know, they have 52 country committees scattered throughout the world, of course, and. Their ability to keep people connected and engaged in this work is just remarkable. You know, well before there was Zooms that all of us are now accustomed to, you guys were pioneers in using video conferencing, teleconferencing to keep people connected and organized. And it's just been fun to watch the work. I've had the fortune now to travel to Japan, to Spain, to Portugal, to the Netherlands, to Germany, to Austria and Switzerland, now Canada. I feel like I'm missing a time.
Oh, you're probably missing a dozen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but the point is,
gotta collect the whole set.
Yeah. That's right. The point for me is, you know, there's other officers. Of course, I'm the number two at the DNC. Most of the time, other officers are traveling. They're raising money for the DNC, or they're raising money for specific candidates. For me, as I've traveled throughout the world to help Democrats Abroad, it's really focused on helping them raise money to help them organize and pump up their volunteer base, really focused on the work that you guys are doing, because it's so important to the Democratic Party writ large. And certainly, I've just been amazed at the work that you guys do. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Ken Sherman's been my roommate on a couple of trips when we take to events and stuff. So yeah, I can honestly say that man has a lot of energy for and he keeps going.
Right.
It's interesting when you talk about the amount of votes that come from Democrats outside of the United States. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I suppose the question for you is why is that? What does that say either about the United States, or what does that say about the world, or what does that say about the way Democrats have left the United States, that so much overseas voting does lead to the Democrat Party?
A great question, David.
Good luck on that one, Ken.
You know, I would ask you guys that question, to be honest with you, because you know, for a long time, I think we saw that the American overseas vote tended to lean a little bit more to the right, particularly because most folks living abroad were connected in some way with the military and the armed forces, right?
Right.
That's changed in time, of course. And I can't point to specifically why, but there's no doubt now. Think about Germany as an example, right? Most Americans living in Germany were there, and a lot still are, because of the massive military presence that the U.S. has there. But as I traveled through Frankfurt and Munich on a recent trip, it's very clear that there are a lot more Americans living and working over there that have no connection to the armed forces. And that's true and growing more and more each year. I don't know why that is, to be honest with you, but it is what it is. And it's something that, as we think about just the math of winning elections, there's a real untapped pool of voters that that we can get, right? People ask me all the time, you know, I've been in politics since 1990, having gotten started with a bushy-haired college professor named Paul Wellstone, who I had the good fortune to work on his campaign and then and then work for him in the Senate. And I'll tell you that as I train folks on various campaigns I've run over the years, people would ask me, well, you know, where do you go to get the votes? Or another way I say it is, you know, people ask me where I go to hunt, right? And they think, well, I'm going to say, you know,
it's a good Minnesota question.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, here's my favorite hunting spot, or, you know, I go to the woods. No, I go where the deer are, right?
Yes.
and I use that to say that that's true of voters too, right? Well, where do you go to get the votes? Well, the reason that Democrats Abroad has become so important is we've seen in recent years an explosion of overseas and abroad voters. And it's an untapped, in really, as I mentioned those numbers before, 7.8% turnout, a million and a half. You know, the average voter turnout throughout the country in the last election was around 67%, the last presidential election. Mm-hmm. So I say that because there's just a lot of upside here in terms of this work that all of you are doing, the organizing, the mobilizing, and the turnout work.
Yeah, for sure. And I was thinking about the military vote, because, of course, one of David's first questions to you was whether people know we exist. And often traditionally, when results have been reported, the overseas vote has been called the military vote. And it's not just the military. And as you say, the military vote itself has been changing. We had Dan Barka from Veterans for Responsible Leadership on the pod a couple of episodes ago, who told us that the military vote is now about 50-50 Democrats and Republicans. And that's a huge change. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear.
Interesting. So let's talk about mood then. What are you encountering in terms of optimism, pessimism, hope, despair?
Yeah, look, I mean, we have 215 days till the election, right? I always say there's three commodities that we have in campaigns. It's time, it's people, and it's money. We can always obviously raise a few more bucks and recruit a few more people. The one thing we can't get back is time. And of course, with 215 days left from today, and there'll be 214 days tomorrow and so on, I think the one thing that I'm sensing is not only a sense of urgency, right, with time ticking away, but probably more importantly, a sense of the true stakes of this election, right? People know that this is an existential moment for our American experiment in democracy. This is a true stress test on our system of government. But more importantly, I think people, you know, every election cycle, people like me get up and say, this is the most important election of your lifetime, right?
And I
would say, and I'll come back to that in a second, every election, of course, is important. But most people, when I say this, they feel it in their bones. They know that this election is the starkest contrast we've had between elected or candidates. And I would just say that the mood I get as I travel around is certainly worry and concern. But I also have, as I've always say, you have to turn your worry into work and your fear into fight, right? Mm-hmm. I do believe that that's when I come into these meetings and talk to folks and listen to folks, they start with deep fear, but you can sense that they're willing to actually turn that fear into fight and to roll up their sleeves and do the hard work of organizing and having tough conversations and you know, reaching out to folks not only in their countries or communities, but, you know, all over the world to make sure that we win. And, you know, truly, as we talked about last night here in Toronto, what happens in the U.S., it doesn't just stay in the U.S. Of course, we are the longest continuous free democracy in the world. And if our democracy falls, which sounds hyperbolic, but truly could happen, it will have a tremendous impact around the world. And so this election isn't just an election for Americans. It's an election for people who care about democracies all around the world.
It's interesting to say we do have to have tough questions and tough conversations. And when I talk to a lot of Americans, and I think about it, we set up a booth for Capital Pride here in Ottawa a little while ago, and you talk to people in the street as they walk past, and sometimes some of the people you talk to are Americans. They are fully aware that they can vote, but they're embarrassed by the United States, and so they just choose not to participate. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, you know, I think when I was on the trip to Europe last May with Democrats Abroad, certainly a number of Americans, many who had been living overseas for some time, couldn't quite get their hands around the abortion politics, as an example.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Or the gun, the mm-hmm. infatuation with guns and gun culture in the U.S., right? And how we can't get our arms around that from a public policy standpoint. So I wouldn't say people were embarrassed to be American, but people didn't quite understand, particularly when you see other, industrialized countries and, in throughout the world who've managed to pass public policy to deal with issues, you know, like this, where you have, universal health care, you have, universal education, the basic needs of citizens are being met by their country. You don't have this infatuation with guns and the level of gun violence that you see in the U.S., right? You don't have people trying to restrict a woman's right to make decisions over her health care, as an example, in a lot of countries. And so I say this because, yes, people are concerned. But what I've been buoyed by is that most of the people I've talked to, and maybe it's a select audience, of course, of folks who are already engaged who are showing up to these events, but I would say most of the folks I talk to, that's the reason they're engaged, because they know that they see the possibility of what America could be in some of their countries that they're living in, right? And they can't understand why we, as the richest country in the world, still have people that are homeless and starving, right? Mm-hmm. The country that's the leading democracy in the world that still has, low voter participation, as an example. They're willing to fight for this country because they've seen the possibility of what it could be.
Welcome back to You Betcha and OGs. Madison Groh, who does your You Betcha go to for the week?
My You Betcha goes out to new parents, Phil and Phyllis, the Groundhogs of Pennsylvania.
Oh, you betcha.
What?
Yeah.
Yes. What? Phyllis had two baby groundhogs a couple weeks ago, and I don't think she was pregnant when we met her, but shortly after, Phil and Phyllis were expecting, and they had two little baby groundhogs, and it's very thrilling, and I can feel like I sort of know them. I know their parents.
Did you coax on their relationship? I saw you spent a lot of time with those two in Punxsutawney.
You know, I like to think I played a part, helped set the mood.
It was amazing because Phil just laid in his little hole and looked at us like, who are these crazy? And Phyllis was running all around. She was pretty active.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm being honest, I didn't know who is who. I just went off the little labels above their little sleepy holes, but
Phil was the one in the tuxedo, probably.
Yeah, I like to believe Phyllis was the active one.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. Who does your OGs for the week go out to?
This is also nature related, but the cicada apocalypse is coming.
Oh, geez.
I'm really worried about it. I had to live through the one in Baltimore. For people who don't know, every 13 and 17 years, cicadas emerge from the ground, and it's like biblical and disgusting, and they attack you, they'll fly in your hair, and it's just the worst thing ever, and I did deal with it in Maryland, and that one was a big one, and now there's an even bigger one coming this year.
Are those the grasshoppers?
No,
they're
they are not locusts, they are not. this, there is a great article about this. Madison Groh is afraid of cicadas.
I'm really afraid of cicadas.
And I sent it to her. It's the cicada Armageddon. The biggest brood is in the South. And it's
they're going to come to the Midwest
and
this
to
year.
The Midwest as well in Illinois. But the biggest brood is in the South. And they'd said there are
trillions.
It will be hundreds of trillions of them in 1 acre.
Biblical.
1 acre, it's biblical. Like over a million cicadas who they live underground for 13 years, and then they all come out at the same time.
Yeah, so right now they're all over the news, and everyone knows I'm really afraid of them, so they all keep sending me pictures of the cicadas emerging, and I'm not happy.
Is it going to happen here?
No.
In Illinois, but I bet those little... get up here. I don't trust them.
Probably too cold, right?
Bass and just keeps moving further and further north.
Honestly, the last the one, I literally left Maryland for here, and now they're coming closer.
So my dad tells a story. He used to be like a beatnik, he called it, back in like the 60s or whatever, mm-hmm. and he rode a motorcycle back and forth across the country a couple times. And one time he was in, I think it was Colorado maybe, he was riding his motorcycle and he hit like a locust or it might have been cicadas. And he said he couldn't see at all. He had a helmet on, and he couldn't see like an inch past. And he said the road was so greasy from these cicadas that he couldn't keep the bike.
I bet.
So he had to basically pull over and sit through this like storm of bugs till it stopped because he couldn't keep the bike on the road because it was so slippery and greasy. Like, that's just disgusting.
That's part of what will happen.
It's pretty much what that.
Wow.
Madison is freaked out. I sent her an article on the airplane and she jumped out of her seat, literally.
It's so
isn't
gross.
That crazy? 13 years? Like, it's just so such a strange.
And they look like aliens when they climb out. And then there's these real freaks, like in Maryland, who get excited about it. And they, like, have cicada festivals and make cicada art. And I'm like, no, they're disgusting. Get out of here.
And so what
did
happens?
Did you read that article about the
no, I didn't read it. I saw the nasty looking.
The bug guy who is expert on cicadas, he also.
Oh, people eat them, too.
Right, that's the thing. He also teaches a class on cooking cicadas because they're a delicacy.
I was going to ask, what do you do with the, I mean, do they pull out
it's
bulldozers?
Like shrimp. People
they're big.
They say they do.
Okay.
And they make a very loud noise. They have cicadas.
They're so loud. Oh.
There are regular cicadas, like in Kansas. Every summer you have cicadas. Right?
Okay.
But they're not as populated.
Got it.
This brood that comes up that lives. The reason they say they live underground is it's an evolutionary tactic. They will live underground because if they lived above ground, they would be, prey for predators, right? So these birds and other animals just feast on these cicadas when they come out. But every 13 to 17 years, right, these broods will come out in the trillions. It's like a million per acre or something like that. It's just nuts.
Sorry, this probably took up too much time.
No, this is good. I didn't know this. This is. I'm glad it's not happening here. I'll just say that.
Wait, are you afraid of bugs too?
I don't want to deal with that.
Wow.
And dogs like love to eat them, and you don't want your dogs to eat them. They're not good for them.
I was just wondering about my dog.
Like, River. Oh my god. Oh.
Wow, you have taken Madison Groh's side on this one, Will.
I mean, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it sounds horrible. I haven't even seen the photos yet.
There you go.
Anyway.
He'll send it to you.
Ken, who's your You Betcha?
My You Betcha goes out to Minnesota State University.
Oh, You Betcha, yeah.
Yeah.
Minnesota State University used to be known as Mankato State back when I was in college and coming up here in Minnesota. They recently changed their name, but more importantly, and as excitingly, here in March Madness, the men's and women's basketball programs of Minnesota State University won the Division II national championships in each.
Cool.
And it was a great game on Friday night. I watched the women win the championship, and then on Saturday, watched the men win the championship on a buzzer beater. The end of the game, brother to brother. This is the great thing. Two brothers played on the same team with just 2 seconds left. Inbound pass to one of the brothers. He passes it down low in the corner to his brother, who hits a three-pointer to win the game.
A rainbow moonshot.
And the national championship. Yeah. It was just great. And congratulations. My son, a first-year student at Minnesota State University, is pretty pumped up.
There we go.
Two championship teams.
That's so cool. We're always thought of as a hockey state, but we have a lot of great basketball players.
Right. You've got a lot of great prospects coming out of the state now, and it's awesome.
Yep. Very cool. Your OGs of the week.
My OGs for the week goes out to RFK Jr.
Oh, geez.
Mm-hmm. Well, good old Bobby Kennedy Jr. This week his campaign sent out a fundraising email that referred to people that are facing charges for the insurrection on January 6th as activists and that they were stripped of their constitutional liberties. Does that language sound familiar? Because if it does to you, it's probably because that's exactly what Donald Trump is doing, is he's referring to these people as good folks who are patriots and they're hostages and they're being unfairly prosecuted. We need to remember, folks, that these are people who knew what they were doing. They were engaged in a violent insurrection. It wasn't just that they broke into the Capitol. That would be one thing. In their attempts of breaking into the Capitol to, by the way, assassinate political leaders, they were attacking police officers, security guards, other Capitol staff, trying to keep them out. So this was not just some group of activists and tourists, as has been said, of these people who violently stormed our Capitol. The fact that RFK would essentially adopt the same language that Trump is on this is really disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, the guy has always pretended to be a Democrat, and now he's, like, doing this stuff. And so he fired this, he blamed it on a vendor, and he fired this vendor, but he will not reveal the name of the vendor. Big shock, big
right.
shock.
Yeah. Right, right. So. Well, I mean, look, he's an anti-vaxxer, right? He denies science and fact, and now he's adopting a lot of the same positions that Trump is. So any idea that this guy is carrying on the legacy of his father, the great RFK, is just not true.
I should also add that kind of along the same vein, No Labels, which is the joke of an organization, has said they're not going to run a candidate this cycle. So that's great news.
It is the death of No Labels.
Yes. Good riddance.
Good riddance, exactly. So, Will, how about you? You betcha for the week.
Yes, mine is going to be kind of similar to yours, but I'm going to do the rise of women's college basketball.
Yes.
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Yeah.
Tonight is like the most epic basketball showdown. It's Connecticut and Minnesota's own Paige Beckers versus Iowa and Caitlin Clark.
Yep.
And
NC State and South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, that's another great one. It's just going to be so much fun. And I mean, women's college basketball is awesome, and people are starting to realize it now, and it's just gonna I'm super hyped up, and I don't think I've been hyped up about
we've been watching women's basketball for years now in my family, and I will tell you, it's been fun to see it coming to its own. The game on Monday night,
the
Iowa LSU game, is 12.5 million viewers that viewed it. It's one of the highest watched sports events, men's or women, in the last year. Right? I saw a list of all of the events that it beat out in terms of viewership, and that should tell you that it's really arrived. Of course, that was a marquee game when you had Angel Reese against Caitlin Clark. Yep. It was a repeat of the national championship from last year, but these games tonight are going to be fantastic. And we'll be watching.
Yeah,
for sure.
Madison, you're not a sports fan. Does this interest you at all as a non-sports fan?
Well, actually, Angel Reese gave her exclusive that she's going pro to Vogue. So I scooped that before Ken and broke the news to him. And I decided after that, I'm going to learn the rules of this basketball that people keep talking
about.
This
round ball game.
Yeah, it sounds like a good time if Vogue's writing about it.
Oh, yeah. Yep, you shoot into a peach basket. Right. And Madison, I would say, even if you don't know the rules, you're going to love, like, the passion and how intense it is. And that's going to be, like, the most fun part. So
I will say, I have heard that all over about college basketball. Even my dad, who's not a big basketball person, loves college basketball. Yeah. He just says there's, like, a lot of heart in it.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. For sure.
Indeed. Indeed.
And, Will, how about your OGs?
My OGs goes out to the House Free Dumb Caucus.
Oh, geez.
We all saw the terrible images of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which is my second favorite American city. And, you know, I think it probably brought a lot of, tough memories back for Minnesotans from the bridge collapse in 35W. And now Joe Biden has vowed that every penny will be for the rebuilding of the bridge will come from federal dollars. And I think there's a lot of agreement in Congress about that, except from the Free Dumb Caucus, who has said they'll do it, but there's some caveats that they want with it. And those include, they want the Biden administration to reverse course on its pause on new export terminal permits for liquefied natural gas. So they want to export natural gas to other countries. So they want to keep enriching the oil mm-hmm. gas companies. And they want the spending to be fully offset by cuts everywhere. And so they're looking at the people of Baltimore who have, they're victims here, purely victims, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they had nothing to do. They don't deserve this whatsoever. No. And they're putting caveats that have nothing to do with them on the board to get this federal dollar. So
and mind I you, hate them. And so mind you, Baltimore port is the largest commercial shipping port on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yep.
And the delay, any delay in both rebuilding that bridge, but getting all of that removed, the salvage operation and getting all that removed, is going to severely impact the economy.
That's right.
And well, so again, the Republicans have put their, shown their true values here, right? They could care less about the American economy. They could care less that they're going to force prices up by their actions. They could care less about the impact it has to the Baltimore community. Once again, the free dumb, I like how you say that because mm-hmm. they're dumb. This caucus has shown that they put their own partisan far-right agenda ahead of any person yep. who lives in this
That's
country.
Right.
Well, and the working-class communities of Dundalk and the communities cut off by that bridge now, they're, those people can't get to work easily.
Like, that's right.
They're the ones that are paying for this. They're the ones that are suffering
that's
from
right.
this. And
that's
they're
right.
not, you know, the affluent people, you know, that everyone wants to say are on the East Coast.
Yeah, no, Baltimore's
working-class families.
Baltimore's a working-class town, no doubt yeah. about it. So.
Madison used to live there.
Yeah, it's an awesome city.
Wonderful city. Everyone should visit Baltimore.
Agreed.
With that, we're going to take a quick break and bring you the facts of Vlad.
You take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of
Vlad.
The facts of
Vlad.
When the world never seems to be living up to your dreams, and suddenly you're finding out the facts of
Vlad.
Around the same time that Whitney Houston sang what many consider the best and most famous rendition of the national anthem in the modern era, prominent Trump surrogate Roseanne Barr sang what many consider the worst at a July 25th, 1990 San Diego Padres game. Hall of Famer Tony Gwynn called it awful.
When the world never seems to be living up to your dreams, and suddenly you're finding out the facts of
Vlad.
Welcome back to DFL Trivia with your host, Kenneth Martin.
Thank you so much, Will. We are back with everyone's favorite segments. Unfortunately, it's always at the end of the show now, but thank you for waiting patiently for your favorite segment. This, of course, this last week's question, which we asked you, was, what was the first elected office that Vice President Kamala Harris ever held? And this was an easy question. We had a lot of correct answers. Kevin P. was the person who got this correct.
Woo-hoo.
And the answer, of course, is the District Attorney of San Francisco was the first office that Kamala Harris was ever elected to in 2003. Mm-hmm. So congratulations, Kevin P. You are the lucky recipient of a $25 gift card to our online store. We've got a lot of great new merchandise up there, actually. I'd encourage all of our listeners to head to dfl.org/store. Great new merchandise that the team's put up there. And don't spend your $25 gift card all in one place. Actually, you can only spend it in one place, but save it because there's even better merchandise to come.
I saw you have some cool new graphics for the store, too.
Yes.
That looked really good. It made me want to almost click on it and buy something.
Wow.
But there's no DFL
almost.
Debrief merch yet, so.
That's right. There you go. This week's, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
We've talked about shirt that says I'm one of the 10 listeners.
Yeah,
DFL debrief.
I'm one of the 10 debriefers.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great.
Nice. All right. This week's question is as follows. What year was the original 35W Mississippi River Bridge first opened for traffic? We're not talking about the replacement mm-hmm. bridge, but the first original 35W Mississippi River Bridge. What year did it open for traffic?
Send in your answers to podcast@dfl.org. Text Darwin, come into the office and tell him to his face. I'm sure he'll be excited for that. Please, please review the show on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcast, and because we could really use it. I mean, our ratings are low here, so please give us 5 stars.
It doesn't have anything to do with the host, by the way.
And we'll see you next week.
I'll tell you, it was one hell of a show.